urinary incontinence does increase as men get older. There are a lot of studies demonstrating various different types of incontinence, but you know, there's a range of how common it is, and up to 40% of men will have some sort of urinary incontinence as they get older. And obviously the type of urinary incontinence was important, and there's various types of incontinence that are more common that we do see more classically in a average male as they get older.
This is the Man Up Podcast, Doctor's Guide to Men's Health. Each week on our podcast, we interview the top specialists of the field on various topics in men's health. You have questions that you are too afraid to ask, we have the answers. This week, our episode is titled, Come Through Dripping, Another Conversation on Male Incontinence. I'm Dr. Kevin Chu, and I'm joined as always with my co-host, Dr. Justin Dubin. Justin, how's that heat out there for you?
It is insanely hot. It's been pretty brutal, but it hasn't stopped me from, you know, hitting the Venetian Causeway early in the morning, starting to be a pickleball guy, so I'm hitting the courts.
Pickleball, huh? Pickleball.
It's fun, man.
You know, I saw this IG thing where they were like, what did they say? They said, like, you know, if you're not athletic enough to play tennis, but you're too poor to play golf, pickleball.
Honestly, that probably describes me pretty well. I like golf, but the problem is this, right? Like, golf, it eats up your whole day. We wake up early. I don't want to wake up at 7:30 in the morning for a 7:30. Like, I don't want to wake up at 6:30 for a 7:30 tea time on a Saturday. I just don't. And then I'm paying $200 for the course unless I have a membership. I have a clubs. I like playing golf. But, you know, I bought a pickleball paddle for $100. Bought some tennis shoes, some nice tennis shoes.
All right, fine. Golf. I see your points on golf, but what about tennis?
I've never learned tennis. I don't know how to do tennis. Like, I would love to play tennis. I'm very intimidated by tennis. This just seems like an approachable sport to me. And there is actually data showing that paddle sports reduces the risk of dementia and improves your overall health. People live longer, I believe, on paddle sports. So tennis, pickleball.
I love that. I love that. And that's why, you know, I play pickleball with my dad.
Do you play pickleball?
You know, it doesn't have to move. I play pickleball with
my
dad.
So why are you shitting on me for pickleball?
Well, because when I, you know, play with other people of my age, I'm usually playing tennis. I'm not shitting on pickleball. I'm just, you know. I enjoy it. No, don't get me wrong. I enjoy pickleball. It's a fun sport.
Well, I never played tennis. I don't even know the rules of tennis. I'm not even going to lie to you. I have no idea.
I think they're pretty similar to pickleball, kind of.
No, there's like sets and matches. Pickleball is just played to like 11, and that's it.
Fine. The concept is fairly similar.
So maybe pickleball is the stepping stone for me to feel less intimidated about tennis.
There you go. All right. I like that. Okay. I like that. What else is new, man?
Nothing really. Living life down in South Florida. How about you?
Things are good here. It's actually pretty hot, like East LA. Like, it's weird. In the way California works is like, it's like extremely hot to like half a mile from the coast. And I live within that half mile of the coast. So like, when it isn't hot, it's actually like kind of cool outside. But then now when it's like really hot in East LA, it's like very nice here. So like, it's like a nice 70s, like kind of all day. So I can't complain where I'm at in LA.
That's good.
But it's definitely heating up inland for
sure. Yeah, I mean, I'm on the water and it's still hot as shit. So, you know, different heat in Miami and LA.
Right.
But talking about the West Coast, we were joined by our good friend and previous co-resident, Dr. Daniel Furlong. So so just to give people a background, you know, residency is when you specialize, you know, you go through med school, you become an MD, you're not a specialist in anything, you just have an MD, and you have to apply for residency, which is your training. So Kevin and I, as I think we've made it quite clear, did our residency get together at University of Miami. There was a third person, and that person is our guest today. It was Dr. Daniel Furlong. So we were in it. We were in our training at Miami for 5 years, and we were the crew, man. This was my best friends for those years, and they're still my best friends now. So, you know, you'll see how comfortable we are with each other. You know, there's a lot of jokes being cracked.
And since this is, you know, Justin and I's podcast, we can say, like, you know, basically, Justin and I were the strongest residents in our class. And, you know, Daniel, you know, he was good.
There's a black sheep. No, there's a black sheep. There's a black sheep. But we've been trying to get him on, and we finally convinced him to get on. And, yeah. And you know, so just a little bit about Dr. Furlong. He is a urologist who's fellowship trained in female pelvic medicine, reconstructive surgery, and voiding dysfunction. So we thought this was a great topic to have him on. He's part of the Department of Urology at Oregon Health and Science University. He cares for patients out of OHSU Adventist Health Portland, offering medical and surgical care for both men and women with a broad range of urological concerns, including voiding dysfunction, neurologic and non-neurologic, urologic cancer survivorship, prostate, bladder, kidney, testicle, pineal cancers, kidney and bladder stones, GU trauma and reconstruction, men's health, and female urological disorders. So he does a lot of stuff, a lot of recon stuff, and a lot of peeing stuff. And then we thought he was a great person to come on and talk about this topic. We had previously had Dr. Ziho Lian, who did an excellent job. But, you know, I think a lot of people reached out and asked a lot more questions, and we felt like there was still some gaps to fill in here.
And it's important in medicine that there are a lot of perspectives. Yeah. And that's what I tell my patients all the time. Like, each urologist, if we're talking about men's health, has different perspectives. And so there's not always a one-size-fits-all kind of treatment plan. So now Dr. Daniel Furlong is able to kind of give his kind of, you know, his perspective and his input on male incontinence, which is a very important topic to talk about.
Yeah, listen. We highlighted in this episode, we highlighted it last episode, when it comes to quality of life, incontinence, peeing problems, leakage, this is really one of those things that can really compromise every aspect of your life, financially, you know, emotionally, physically. It's really debilitating, and it's very embarrassing for guys to talk about. So, you know, this is something that we really want you guys to understand, that you can fix things. We go through a lot of lifestyle stuff in this one, which we didn't discuss last time as much. You know, lifestyle things you can do on your own to improve your urinary incontinence status, as well as other options for you to get care for.
Yeah, you're absolutely correct. This isn't something that you have to live with. There are things that we can do, you know? And so this episode was really informative. It was fun. And I think that's, you know, our listeners, you know, you're going to get a kind of a taste of how our lives and how we kind of chatted for 5 years with really good information on top.
Yeah, we definitely shit on each other a bit here, which was good. That was a good banter that I did miss amongst all three of us. But all right, I think we're ready to go. What do you think, Kev?
Sounds like it. Let's jump right in. All right.
All right. Well, before we do, though, don't forget, download, subscribe, give us a review, 5 stars, comment, give us reviews, download and review, actually, also, and subscribe on YouTube is also where we really want to get our YouTube numbers up. Really important for us. You know, share it with a friend. If you have someone who has an issue, share the episodes. You know, you don't have to listen to them sequentially. There's a lot of great topics out there. We're going to keep bringing them out. So keep listening. So thanks a lot, guys. Enjoy the episode.
Did you know that over 25 million Americans experience bladder leaks?
Incontinence can happen to anyone at any time. And when it does, incontinence products are a necessity. But it can cost hundreds of dollars per month to purchase these products, which is why we're partnering with Aeroflow Urology to help you.
Aeroflow Urology provides medical-grade continence care essentials like adult briefs, male guards, catheters, and more for free through your insurance. With Aeroflow, your favorite bladder control supplies are sent right to your doorstep with their discreet monthly deliveries.
Customers have reported close to $200 a month in savings with Aeroflow Urology, and over 2 million people have trusted Aeroflow to verify their insurance benefits. All you need to do is fill out their quick 2-minute form.
To check you or your loved one's eligibility, visit aeroflowurology.com/manuppod. That's aeroflowurology.com/manuppod.
As men's health specialists, we know guys are shaving their balls. Yeah, we examine a lot of you, so we literally see it, but we also have the data showing it, too.
That's right. According to research, over 85% of men trim their pubes. Not only that, but research shows that over 70% of women prefer a partner with at least partially trimmed pubic hair.
So guys, we know you're trimming the edges, and we know that most women prefer you manscape. So if you're going to shave your balls, why not use the best men's grooming kit around? We're talking about Manscaped.
With the Manscaped Performance Package 4.0, you get the Lawnmower 4.0 with their all-new skin-safe electric trimmer that protects your balls from getting those cuts we've all had in the past. You also get the Weed Whacker 2.0 for trimming your nose and ear hairs. And let me tell you guys, we all need to do a better job of this.
Yep, that's right. Kevin and I both have the Performance Package, and we really love it. Manscaping has never been easier for us. And for our listeners, we have a special promotion. Go to manscaped.com and enter promo code MANUP and get 20% off your first purchase.
Go get your Manscaped products today. Your balls and your partner will thank you. So we are joined by Dr. Daniel Furlong. And we're going to really have a great conversation on urinary incontinence. Now, Dr. Daniel Furlong really holds a special place in, you know, Justin and I's, you know, hearts. He was actually our third member of our residency. So, Daniel, thank you for taking the time to come on and hang out with us today.
Yeah, I think you just couldn't find anyone else today, huh?
No, we really couldn't. You know,
we really had to reach down to the.
We forgot about you. We had to kind of bring you on so we could actually have a conversation with you.
Oh, we know that's a lie.
We kind of miss you. We kind of miss you.
No, but Daniel's doing some great work. And, you know, you're doing some great work, and you know, you've studied a lot on, you know, voiding and all that stuff. So we're gonna have a good conversation today. So let's jump into it. All right.
Sounds good.
So, all right. So, Daniel, how common is urinary incontinence among men?
Well, it's pretty common. You know, urinary incontinence does increase as men get older. And it's there are a lot of studies demonstrating various different types of incontinence. But, you know, there's a range of how common it is. And up to 40% of men will have some sort of urinary incontinence as they get older. And obviously the type of urinary incontinence is what's important. And there's various types of incontinence that are more common that we do see more classically in a average male as they get older.
That's pretty high though, 40%. I didn't realize. So that's really, you know, someone you know probably has incontinence to some degree. And I know that a lot of us, you know, our like as parents get older, these are things that we deal with. And obviously, as we get older, some of our friends, family members, and potentially ourselves will too. So that number is actually concerning. And then with that 40%, obviously there can be a lot of problems other than the stress incontinence itself that comes along with it. So what are some of the complications potentially associated with urinary incontinence? And I know there's a different kind, so we'll get into that later, but.
Yeah, of course. I mean, you know, sitting in a wet diaper all day is just bad for hygiene, of course. It can cause skin breakdown. It is embarrassing, so it leads to social isolation. You know, it leads to depression. You know, men can't partake in their normal daily lives. They can't play golf as they get older because they're worried about making it through a hole without having an accident. They don't want to go to, you know, the football game anymore with a grandson because they're scared that they won't be able to make it to the bathroom in time. So I think it's a huge quality of life issue that is often neglected by patients themselves because they're so embarrassed by it.
You bring up a great point, and it's something that I've seen a lot of my patients. It's that embarrassment factor. Like, you know, they just don't, you know, just don't want to. You know, you're afraid to go out into the social situations because you just don't want to have, you know, an accident. I had a patient who was having some pretty bad urge incontinence, and it just like was like, you know, the lines for the opera that he was going to, they were just so long, and he was having accidents in there, and he was wearing like, you know, formal wear, and he was just like, this is having a huge impact in my life, and I can't even attend the things that I want to. So, you know, that's a fantastic point you bring up, that embarrassment is something that, you know, it's really affects the patient.
Yeah, totally.
I would also think that, I think that a lot of guys, if you had to ask, and, you know, we've all taken care of patients who had something like a post-prostatectomy, who've had both ED and urinary incontinence. And I think that if you had to ask either one, if they had to choose, most guys will say, give me the ED any day. I just can't be incontinent because of the things that you're saying, exactly 100%, because it is a really, you know, a quality of life in a day to day, hour to hour basis.
I mean, totally. I mean, you're asking someone, obviously I'm biased because I chose my field and you guys chose your field within urology. But, you know, I would say that the happiest patient is the patient who is going through diapers and diapers a day, and then you get them dry. No patient in urology, at least, is happier than that, because it really affects their quality of life a bit more so than, you know, getting a boner. And I firmly believe that.
Firmly, nice.
Like that? I was waiting to see if you heard that. That it's called a pun.
Well, Dano, on that note, we're talking urinary incontinence, yeah. Leakage, all right? Yeah. So what causes urinary leakage in men?
Yeah, totally. I mean, there can be a structural issue, and that's commonly seen, you know, and the most common thing that we see, obviously, as urologists is in post-prostatectomy incontinence, whether that's after radical prostatectomy for cancer or from benign disease where, you know, the resection of the prostate tissue was a little bit too close to the sphincter. And oftentimes we see, rarely do we see that type of incontinence, but it does sometimes happen as well. The other type of incontinence, which I think is more common as men get older, is from the urgency incontinence. And that can be related to a multitude of factors, whether it's a neurologic issue. We see it oftentimes in patients who have a history of stroke, patients with uncontrolled or longstanding diabetes, their bladders get affected. And just like any other organ of the body, the bladder is an innocent bystander as well. And the nerves affecting the bladder are hurt by diabetes. And in turn, the bladder gets overactive. And those patients have urge incontinence. So urge incontinence, sorry, and I didn't define that, is the leakage that patients have when they feel the urge to go to the bathroom and then they can't make it in time and then they have an axe in their pants, as opposed to stress incontinence where it's a structural issue where they cough, sneeze, go pick up a bunch of heavy weights, and then they leak because the pressure inside their abdomen causes an accident. So those are two very different types of leakage. And then of course there's other leakage after that, like nocturnal enuresis or peeing the bed at nighttime, or post-void dribbling when you're done peeing and you still have a couple drops left over, or even functional incontinence. So men who are just debilitated in the nursing home can't make it to the bathroom in time because they're stuck in their wheelchair and they don't have the nurse or aide to help them get to the bathroom. So we could talk about each of those incontinence for a whole podcast if we needed to.
It's so interesting. And obviously, because there's so many different forms of this, you know, you're a specialist here. What are some different tests that guys can get done to diagnose the different causes of urinary incontinence? How do they do that? Go about it.
I mean, totally. So, I mean, you go and see a urologist or even a primary care doctor, and they can, you know, kind of tease out what type of incontinence is happening based on just the history itself. You know, asking about daytime frequency and urgency and leakage. And do you leak when you have the urge and you can't make it to the bathroom? Or do you leak because you are, you know, bending over and picking up a bunch of the newspaper in the morning and then you have an accident? Those are two different, very different types of incontinence. A physical exam, you know, your doctor pulling down your pants and asking you to cough and seeing if leakage happens. Those are very simple ways of finding out. Urologist checking for a post-void residual, you know, putting a bladder scanner on the bladder after you pee and making sure that the bladder's empty. You know, sometimes we find out that the patient's having a lot of leakage and we scan their bladder and they have a liter of urine left over. And they're just, you know, they're topping off very fast and their bladder's not doing a good job of emptying and they're just leaking because they're at capacity and they're unaware of it. those are simple tests that a primary care doctor or urologist can do to find out. Of course, urinary tract infections can cause incontinence as well. So those always need to be ruled out. And then rarely do we need to do more invasive tests. Sometimes we have to do urodynamics, which is a invasive test where we check how the function of the bladder works. We fill the bladder up with iodine contrast, and we see it on x-ray. If we have fluoroscopy, not all urologists do, but I'm fortunate to work in an academic center that we have the resources to be able to do that. But we check the pressures that the bladder generates when it fills, and then we see what happens if the bladder is unstable and has involuntary contractions. And then we see what happens when a patient is asked to cough, and we see if they leak when they cough as well. And you know, our management is guided by what type of leakage we see on urodynamics as well. But that's not necessarily a test that everyone needs, but some patients do.
Thanks for bringing up the post-void residual. You know, that's a test that we kind of do often because it's easy, and we're dealing a lot with voiding. And I do have, every time I tell a patient, I guess we do it so common. You know, sometimes I'm like, all right, we're just going to check to see how much urine you've emptied, you know, after you've peed, you know. They're like, are you gonna stick something inside me, you know? Yeah, you know, so like, oh, wait, actually, it's, you know, you're right. It's just, we just place a little probe, a little bladder scanner, and we can detect how much urine is left in the bladder after you void it. And it's actually a really useful, it helps us really kind of understand kind of the mechanisms of what's kind of going on in the way you're voiding. Now, I kind of want to dial back a little bit, actually.
Yeah.
Now, so we're talking about urinary leakage, and one of the things with urinary leakage is that guys have to wear diapers or, you know, liners. And, you know, this idea that of a diaper divide, you know, this is actually a terminology that I recently learned about, Justin, I think you did as well. And wearing diapers due to incontinence is not only inconvenient, but expensive. So can you highlight this, you know, diaper divide that's found in patients?
Yeah, I mean, so there was actually a recent survey that came out, and they actually showed that about 70% of respondents have not been able to afford diapers, while 72% continuously struggle to buy products due to affordability. So obviously this is a problem. You know, you want to, if you're a guy going out there and you're having issues with, you know, incontinence, this is something you want to either address, you know, by getting the care you need and seeing a urologist as well. And more concerning is that more than half, about 66% of those surveys admitted that they had to choose between buying incontinence products and other necessities such as food, electricity, on a frequent basis. And, you know, it doesn't only compromise, as we were, you know, alluding to, you know, your physical wellness, it can impact your financial wellness and your mental wellness. You know, this survey also showed that about 2/3, about 60%, admitted that their mental health had been negatively impacted by needing diapers or caring for someone with incontinence. So, you know, this is something that's real, and a lot of guys struggle with this, and it's something that, you know, can be costly, and you know, it can be physically you know, compromising, it can be mentally compromising, it can be socially compromising. So this is something that's really important, and there is this big diaper divide that, you know, should and needs to be addressed, especially, and that's why we're lucky we have people like Daniel out there too.
Thank you.
That was really well said. Now, you know, Daniel, one of the things you talked about earlier was, you know, I guess you kind of touched on it. Like, what, you know, what are risk factors, you know, for our listeners that really put you at risk for developing urinary incontinence in men?
Yeah, totally. So, you know, I alluded to just prostate related procedures. That's definitely one. And we talked about uncontrolled diabetes. That's definitely another. Another thing I briefly mentioned are neurologic causes, like patients who have a history of stroke or MS, multiple sclerosis, or Parkinson's disease. Patients that have a history of any sort of spinal cord injury, depending on the level, can experience issues with urinary incontinence as well. Medications or alcohol or drug use can cause urinary incontinence. And the list goes on.
There's a million reasons. There's a million ways that you can get it. And it's, you know, I always highlight for a lot of my patients the diabetes, because I feel like everyone ignores diabetes. They think it's a hands, eyes, feet. It's the silent killer because you don't have a problem until you have a problem. But, you know, people don't realize it compromises your erections. It compromises your bladder. Like, I've seen multiple guys who had poorly controlled diabetes that they have an their bladder doesn't function anymore. They have a completely dysfunctional bladder. So it is a really important thing to understand that although some of these are not preventable, there is a huge amount of them that, you know, being on top of your health is key.
Totally. I mean, you know, I think it's very obvious to men when they go to the urologist and they find out they have erectile dysfunction, let's say, and they're related to their diabetes. I think very oftentimes, their urinary symptoms is overlooked by lots of physicians, including urologists sometimes, and patients do have diabetes. So we always like to blame it on prostate issues. You know, you have urinary frequency and urgency because your prostate's getting bigger. But, you know, we forget that patients might have uncontrolled diabetes as well, and we do a prostate surgery on them, and then they're having worsening urinary issues, and now they're having incontinence because their outlet is now shaved down. So this is not something that should be neglected. And it's definitely something that patients need to be aware of when they make the choice of whether or not to be compliant on their medication or seek care for their diabetes, because, you know, it does affect the bladder, and it can become the most miserable aspect of their diabetes in their disease course. So super important.
You're absolutely right. I remember a patient that, you know, their diabetes has caused other issues, but then now this, you know, they were basically overflowing. Their bladder was just completely decompensated from the diabetes. And, you know, that aspect of it, you know, we'll maybe talk about it a little bit later, but, you know, in his case, they were kind of like cathing all this stuff. It's really affected their life, changed them, you know?
Completely.
And so that kind of touches on the next question. I think we kind of answered it, but like, you know, are there ways to prevent urinary incontinence in men?
Yeah, totally. You know, there are lifestyle changes that we do, you know, eating healthy, losing weight. There are a lot of studies demonstrating that, you know, metabolic syndrome in itself is a risk factor for urge incontinence. And that's all related to diabetes and diabetic cystopathy, as we like to call it. You know, in diabetes, the bladder first becomes overactive, and the overactive bladder causes leakage, and then eventually the bladder just stops squeezing out completely, and then that's when those patients need a really cath, and then they are leaking because they're overflow. So there's two different leakages happening in that disease course. There are studies showing that patients undergoing bariatric surgery, those patients' urinary incontinence improves. Their lower urinary tract
syndrome
improves.
That's wild.
So the 5% of your weight body loss, 5% of the weight that you lose, you know, the amount of leakage episodes decreases as well. So weight definitely plays a factor. And that's more so, there's also relation to stress incontinence as well. That's more so in women than men, but it shouldn't be neglected either. And as you can imagine, the more weight that you have, the more intra-abdominal pressure that you're causing on the bladder to cause leakage, you know, especially in men who are having structural issues, let's say post-prostatectomy incontinence, men who are very, very overweight. So, you know, everything's connected.
It's great, because every time we talk about it on this podcast, we're always like, you know, what's good for your heart is good for your penis, but what's good for your heart is good for your bladder. You know, just, you know, it's a different aspect that it's all connected, right? Because I didn't know that information actually. So that was really important. I'm just going to put this in layman's terms. Basically, if you're overweight, you're probably going to have worse piss problems, right? That's the bottom line. You're going to have worsening potential urinary issues, whether it's potentially stress incontinence, more likely if you're a female, if you have urge incontinence. And that's because, you know, your body, believe it or not, your bladder, your penis, these are good surrogates for your overall health and how you take care of yourself. And your lifestyle, your weight is is it directly correlated to how you get an erection and how you pee.
Totally.
So, I mean, if it's not, this is not a wake up call. I don't know what it is to lose weight, exercise, and eat healthy.
Yeah. And then, you know, based on the lifestyle modifications that we talk about, you know, I have patients that come in from all over the state of Oregon, all over the Pacific Northwest, because, you know, there's such a shortage of urologists, you know, within these rural areas. And, you know, they drive hours to come and see me, and I do a quick history, and I find out, hey, I'm drinking 3 liters of soda a day, and I'm drinking, you know, 5 coffees in the morning, and now I'm having urgency and leak, and I can't make it to the bathroom. And, you know, some of this seems obvious to us, but it's not necessarily that obvious to patients who don't necessarily have the education, you know, of what these things they put in their bodies can do to them. So, you know, decreasing sodas, decreasing coffee.
Right,
so expand on that.
Kevin was going to ask. Yeah, Kevin. But Dan, you read my mind, Kev.
Expand on that. All right. Expand on this. So, yeah, drinking soda, yeah, it's unhealthy. You know, drinking too much coffee can be unhealthy. But tell the listeners why that can cause urinary incontinence.
Totally.
Like how or why?
I mean, I can get into the very detail, but I'll big picture. You know, coffee, sodas, they're diuretics first and foremost. So they make your body excrete water and, you know, diurese or get all the water to your bladder. That's one way. The other way is that they're bladder irritants and they're bladder irritants because they change the sensitivity of your bladder. So your bladder feels an urge quicker than it normally would have otherwise. So if you're loading up if you're loading up on soda, you're loading up on coffee, your bladder is just going to be really affected. And then you're going to have these involuntary bladder contractions that, you know, you wouldn't have had otherwise. So that's one of the first things I tell my patients. I really try to find out what their fluid management is. What are you drinking every day? What do you start for when you wake up in the morning? What's your first drink you have? How many coffees do you have? How many green teas are you drinking? And then are you drinking all day throughout the night? How much fluid are you drinking? Some, you know, there's this thought that everyone needs to, you know, drink so much, all this fluid to, you know, make your kidneys healthy. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I hear patients say, I thought I'm supposed to drink lots and lots of water. I do bladder diaries with all my patients who come in for voiding dysfunction. And I find out what they're drinking. You know, I see how much they're drinking over 24 hours and how much they're peeing over 48 hours, 24 hours at a time. And I then can see, you know, hey, dude, like, what are you doing, man? You're drinking like, what do you think is going to happen when you drink this amount of Mountain Dew every day? And then they're crazy. Like, doctor, oh my God, I stopped drinking so much Mountain Dew. And like, I'm sleeping through the night now. And like, I'm not wearing any diapers anymore. It's crazy. It seems obvious, but you know, that's a huge difference that you can make in patients' lives by just addressing simple things without medication.
It's crazy. And like, I just want a further clarification. Two things I have a question of. One, you know, it's the caffeine. I want people to understand the caffeine. So my first question is, you know, if I'm changing, you know, some people, they have a soda fix and I understand that, right? Like if I change from caffeinated to decaf coffee to decaf soda, am I doing something there? Is that improving it?
I don't,
is the bubbles, because there's a bubbly aspect.
No, I don't think you need to change and not drink any more caffeine. Like, I'd be a hypocrite to say that. I need to have a coffee before work every day. Like, if I didn't, right, I would be fired from my job. So I no one would come and see me as a physician. So what I do is I have a coffee every day. But do you need to have 4 coffees every morning? That's you know, no one needs that. You know, and if you do, spread it out through the day, but I would say, you know, limit your coffee. So if you're drinking 5 cups of coffee, try drinking 2 cups of coffee and seeing, or 3 cups of coffee and tapering it down, you know, and getting to maybe 2 cups of coffee in the morning and seeing if that helps you, or spacing it out throughout the day. And that goes for sodas as well. But cutting anything out completely, I think is unrealistic. You know, with all patients, you'll never get the results that you need. By just quitting things like that, except for smoking, of course.
And then stop smoking. But my second question is, you're alluding to it. How much water is too much water? Like, how much water should I actually be drinking?
Yeah, I mean, I think the goal amount of water is at least over a liter of water a day. There's no one's going to tell you to drink less than that. But if you're drinking, you know, three and a half liters of fluid in a day, and that includes, you know, food has fluid as well in it. So people forget that as well. So if you're drinking more, you know, within over 3 liters of fluid a day, that's some, and you're having symptoms, then you need to make some behavioral changes. But I think that's key, right? Of course, but not everyone's having.
What you said, if it's causing symptoms,
exactly.
If it's not causing symptoms,
if you're not bothered by it, then drink as much fluid as you want. You know, but if it's causing,
I'm drinking 3 liters now. I'm trying to. I got my big.
That's
gut.
Actually impressive. I could not do it. Like, I feel like you're just drinking all day.
Yeah, but you also have to remember that you're also losing fluids, you know, when you're out and exercising as well. So someone who is very active in their lifestyle might need to drink more fluid than someone like your friend
that's
Daniel.
Correct, Justin, that's why you don't need much fluid.
No, it's a good point. It's a good point. Like, well, I should drink more water. I think I drink maybe 1 liter.
Dude, I see your Instagrams. You're out on the Venetian Causeway running, man. You got your fluid loss, man. You got to be in negative balance right now.
Dude, I have like 2 bottles of water maybe a day. That's it. I got
to
do better.
But it's also, Kevin, it has to do with how tall you are and how much body mass you have. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had a, you know, couldn't do a podcast on making fun of Dubin's height. Do your listeners know how tall you are or no?
I'm five.
You know, this is called this is called Man Up because we want Justin to stand and see how tall he is. All right.
No, we just wanted you to hear your beautiful voice. That's exactly. What I had to hear.
Exactly.
All right, so let's dial back. So let's talk about medical treatment options for urinary leakage in men.
Yeah.
I know there's, you know, Dan, I know there's different types, but just kind of give us a summary, you know, in general for the different types, you know, you kind of break it down, stress, urge, whatever.
Yeah, of course.
You know, are there, you know, medical treatments?
Yeah, I mean, we'll start with the urge because that's the most common thing that we do with medical treatment. The class of medications that we use for the past couple of decades are the anticholinergic medications, and there's tons of them. There's oxybutynin is probably the most common one, and there's trospium and tolteridine, and I can go down the list. And I don't really prescribe those medications anymore if I can avoid it, because they have a lot of side effects, and the side effects include the main ones are dry mouth, constipation, and cognitive side effects like brain fogs, and with long-term use can cause dementia as well. A lot of these patients that you see, and I didn't talk about this before, who have urinary incontinence also have concurrent constipation, and that can be an exacerbating factor of the urinary incontinence. So now if you're slamming these patients with a medication that causes more constipation, you're just putting them on a hamster wheel of constipation and you're making them worse, and then they're becoming demented later on. So I mean, I mean that facetiously, but in reality, I really try to avoid those medications because we have better medications to offer our patients now. Unfortunately, insurance companies, as we all know, kind of own doctors, and we can't give our patients the medications that we need to give them because insurance companies won't cover them. And then the medications that work, you know, with less side effects are more expensive. And those include the beta-3 agonists like Mirbetriq or Gemtesa. And those medications work amazingly. I have patients that, are having horrible lower urinary tract symptoms, urgency, leakage. I start them on these medications. And then by the next appointment, they're thanking me and couldn't be happier.
And it's amazing, and you
feel so good about, you know, what you're doing, and it reminds you that, you know, what you're doing matters at work. And those are the types of patients that really make you feel happy to be a doctor. There are new medications coming out, you know, that are in the pipeline as well. But until then, we're stuck with these two main class of medications for urge incontinence. For stress incontinence, in men, and that's related generally to post-prostatectomy causes, there really isn't any medication that we can give. You know, there are some SSRIs that have been given off-label for stress incontinence.
Really?
But, you know, I don't use that, especially in men. I think that that's not necessarily, you're not really addressing the issue when you're having stress incontinence. Right. And the issue is because there is an anatomic problem. So yeah, that those are basically the medications. And then we can talk about, you know, third line therapies. If you consider Botox a medication, which technically it is, I often do give Botox for certain patients who need it as well.
No, so I think the main point is, even if you don't want a surgery, there are potential options for a lot of these forms of urinary incontinence. You know, let's briefly touch on some of the surgical treatments now. And I know that this is mostly, when we're talking about surgical treatments, we're mostly talking about stress incontinence, but I'll let you take the floor from here.
Yeah. So the main, surgical treatments for stress incontinence in men are...
No, for all, yeah, for, sorry.
So we're talking about men, right?
Men,
yeah.
Men only. Men only. Man up.
For men, we talk about artificial urinary sphincters, and that's the gold standard for stress incontinence in men. It works very well. It's definitely the most invasive surgery that we offer for stress incontinence for the most part. You know, and that works by inserting a tiny cuff that goes around the urethra, and it's connected to a pressure-regulating balloon that's put inside the pelvis. And then there's another arm that's connected to a control pump that's placed in the scrotum. And this little cuff around the urethra stays inflated. And when you press the pump, the fluid goes out the cuff into the pressure regulating balloon and allows the urethra to be open, and patients are able to pee. And then after about a minute or more, the cuff reinflates with fluid, and then patients are continent again. And it works very well. But of course, there are risks of those surgeries. And over time, like anything, they stop working. Any medical device. I've seen these last for, you know, the longest I've seen them in these last is about 25 years. But
it's amazing.
But you know, wow. they generally don't last that as long as that. And they do probably need to be replaced at some point, depending on the patient's age and when they get them placed in the first place. So. That's one option. Another option, which doesn't work as well, but it's less invasive, is a male sling. And those are very good surgeries for certain types of post-prostatectomy incontinence for patients who have lower volume leakage. They're quicker surgeries, and patients are able to, don't need to squeeze a pump to go to the bathroom. They basically just go like they normally do. And it's basically a polypropylene mesh sling that goes underneath the urethra. And basically gives support to the urethra to allow continence to be restored.
That's excellent. You know, I want to stress to our listeners, you know, the artificial urinary sphincter, like, you know, all three of us, we see patients after they've had this placed, you know. Mm-hmm. I know Dano puts a lot more in it than Justin and I, but we do too. And, you know, the change in quality of life after that.
It's insane.
It's insane. You have now this device that are able to almost essentially as close to dry as you can, and you've really gotten back your life. You're back out on the golf course. You're on the airplanes without any issue. And I'm a bit, you know, Justin and I are a bit partial to the penile prosthetics because that's what we do more of. But like, I gotta say, the AUS is really, man.
It's awesome. It's awesome, right?
Yeah. I mean, when it works well, there's no happier patient than a patient that has had their AUS activated. And of course, you know, we all see the complications that can happen. But I will tell you, you know, I had patients, especially in fellowship, where I had a guy that was going on his sixth revision because when it worked great. And he didn't care that he had to keep getting the taken out and putting it in because he just wanted to be dry. So, I mean, that's how well it works is, you know, and the reasons for the revision didn't necessarily have to do with the device itself, but the patient had a lot of issues and complications. And one of the revisions in his lifetime had gotten infected and he had to get it replaced. And another one broke at some point. And then, you know, go on and go on, but it just worked so well that he didn't really care how many times he had to go to the operating room as long as he was dry, and he was thrilled when he was dry. So it was super critical for men and women to not be living in diapers. I mean, that is something that it shouldn't be forgotten by any sort of provider. Obviously urologists don't take that for granted, but I do think that, you know, it can be minimized by other physicians who don't necessarily treat these issues.
Love that. You know, that's the importance of what we're doing here, is just trying to get that awareness out, and that there are things that you know, any of our listeners who are dealing with urinary leakage, there are things that can be done, whether it be lifestyle, medical, or surgical. Now, Daniel, we're going to go a little bit on to the back on the other spectrum. You know, there's patients who come in who complain about post void dribbling. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, they see like a little, you know, after they pee, they see a little
all
bit on
ages.
Their underwear.
All ages,
right? They're like, I got a little dot on my, you know, a little wet spot on my underwear.
Yeah.
You know, so what can we do about this? How should guys do?
Post-void dribbling is something that hasn't been extensively studied. The thought is that, you know, and there's a lot of different theories, but, you know, the main, one of the main thoughts are weakening of the bulbospongiosis muscle, or the muscle that's over the bulbar urethra in the perineum, or in the gooch, as we say. And it just doesn't squeeze out all the urine at the end of peeing. However, you know, it can happen in an enlarged prostate. There's just a little bit of urine that's left over that then leaks out afterwards. Patients who don't empty their bladder all the way, maybe there's still a little bit of urine left over just in the urethra. But there's no good test to figure out why patients might have some post-void dribbling. But what I tell all patients is to try just urethral stripping. So you take a finger, you press it underneath your scrotum, and you kind of just strip the urethra of all the leftover fluid. And it works pretty well. I have a couple patients who are horrified that they have a couple drops. And then when I go and see it, you know, it's can be less than we're used to when we talk about incontinence. And sometimes it's just a little bit of counseling and reassurance that's needed as well. We sometimes do offer pelvic floor physical therapy to see if that can help. And that's something that we didn't talk about at all, but that's something that definitely should be addressed. I constantly am referring my patients to pelvic floor physical therapy for their various forms of urinary incontinence. And then we could talk a whole podcast
I'm
about
bring
that.
You there. Yeah. Yeah. I want to bring you up there. Just the urethral stripping is a new term that I just heard from you. Cause I just tell guys to milk it. That's literally,
yeah,
I go stick your hands under your balls and just run it through the urethra, yeah. But it's all age groups. So like, I think a lot of guys, it sounds like they're either in a rush, they're not taking their time, especially the younger guys. And you just gotta, you know, shake it.
You just gotta shake it.
Yeah. But you know, now to follow up on your pelvic floor physical therapy, I think that's an incredibly important point, because pelvic floor physical therapy has so many good values. We brought it up for things like erectile dysfunction. They're starting to show for premature ejaculation, it might be a good option as well. Now, for urinary incontinence, obviously it's a very powerful tool, and people associate it with women's urinary incontinence, but it also has a role in men. So can you just highlight that a little bit more? What's the role of pelvic floor physical therapy in urinary incontinence?
Yeah, totally.
And for men.
I mean, I had a patient the other day who was at, you know, had his prostate removed and it was having some leakage, and he was like, so I'm just going to do Kegels. And it's not, and you know, he's like, my wife does Kegels, I'm not doing that. And it, you know,
right.
And that's not just all, you know, pelvic floor physical therapy is. If it was, then all these physical therapists who get additional training in pelvic floor physical therapy wouldn't exist, right? So it's more than just Kegels. Right. But Kegels is definitely an aspect of pelvic floor physical therapy. But, you know, it's also understanding the various muscles in your pelvic floor and how to target them, bladder training and time voiding. So figuring out protocols to lengthen the amount of time that you can wait to get into the bathroom, and learning how to do urge suppression and various types of techniques for urge suppression. So feeling the urge to go to the bathroom, and then, you know, creating different management strategies and exercises to prevent the urge from happening and lessening that urge. you know, I'm not going to lie and sit here and say I'm a pelvic floor physical therapist. And I know exactly how to take a patient through an evaluation and workup for pelvic floor physical therapy. What I can say is that they utilize all these various different exercises, and patients are very happy if they can stick with the program. And a lot of times patients come back and they tell me, oh my God, I had no idea that I could do X, Y, or Z with these muscles. One of the things I have always found interesting with pelvic floor physical therapy and urinary control in men specifically, one of the things they talk to you about is, you know, try to target your penis to move. So can you get your penis to move?
It's like the force.
Yeah, it's like the force. And it's like when you're a little kid. Yeah. But in reality, if you can get your penis to, you know, lift up, that's targeting your pelvic floor. And
without getting a bone.
Without getting a, you know, getting that.
We're all doing it right now.
We're all doing it right now.
I'm trying so hard right now.
But that's just.
Wait, like a soft one. A soft one. Gotta get up.
Sure.
But I don't think any point.
I think Kevin and I don't have erections right now. So. What's going on in Miami? Comment. Can't see what's going on in Miami right now.
Wait, Kevin, you were gonna say something?
Well, I'll say to your point though. Yeah, when you're able to do that, you are squeezing like certain muscles, right?
Yeah,
it's like kind of like, you know. And, you know, it's making you think that way to it's something that you think subconsciously for most part, right?
Totally, totally. And, you know, for women, you know, when they go to pelvic floor physical therapy, sometimes the therapist will tell them to, like, they'll put the finger in the vagina, the therapist, and they'll tell them to create the sensation that you're pulling the finger inside. You know, that's not just Kegels. There's more than just, you know, squeezing and crunching down your pelvic floor. So there's a lot of different exercises that are being utilized in pelvic floor physical therapy that are very beneficial to men and women who are experiencing urinary incontinence.
Awesome. Now, you know, we've talked about, you know, medical problems, like physical medical problems, but what about supratentorial? You know, how does stress and anxiety play a role in urinary incontinence? Can it worsen it to some degree?
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think patients who have a lot of stressors in their life, it manifests in various ways, whether they, you know, manifest to them in GI related stress. So the patients who have, you know, abdominal pain, they get diarrhea when they get nervous or anxious. You know, the bladder can be affected too. We see it oftentimes in these bladder pain syndromes, but they also have urinary symptoms as well, urgency and frequency. We also see it oftentimes in patients who have, you know, history of sexual abuse as well, or just physical abuse. You know, they develop poor toilet training behaviors when they're at children, and that carries on through adulthood as well. So all these various psychosocial stressors totally can affect the bladder. And another reason that it requires a multidisciplinary approach using urologists and pelvic floor physical therapists and normal, you know, psychological and psychiatric care as well.
That was a great summary. You know, it's something I always tell my patients that, you know, it really takes a team, you know, and it's not just, you know, urologists, you know, by ourselves may not be the sole answer, even though I would love for that to be, but sometimes, you know, there's a lot of things. You know, Justin and I talk a lot about erections. We don't do it by ourselves. It takes a team. You know, we have our sex therapist. And I think in this way, when we're talking here about bladder control, a lot of that also can, you know, there's a lot of components. And so it's a really team approach. But so on that note, so, you know, for our listeners, you know, when should a patient that's dealing with urinary leakage, you know, when should they go see a healthcare professional?
If it's bothering them, you know, if it's bothering them, they should 100% see a healthcare provider. If they are not bothered by it, it's hard to say why they wouldn't be, but if they're not bothered by it, then there's no reason to address it, right? Because you're not, there's no intervention that doesn't have its risks or its downsides. You know, pelvic floor physical therapy, you still have to go to pelvic floor physical therapy and have someone drive you or drive yourself, and that you have to leave work or take off time from work. So, you know, medication obviously has side effects. Surgery, of course, has its risks. So, you know, I tell patients, you know, we only only address things that are bothersome to you. But generally, urinary incontinence is going to be bothersome for men, you know, because we're talking about men.
It was a great question that we both agreed was a great question when we asked it. Kevin asked it, though, but I thought it was a really good question. Now, I think that was it, man. I think that was a really great way to end it. You know, really appreciate you coming on. It was good to catch up and see your beautiful face.
Thank you.
As always. So can you tell our listeners where they can find you, where you practice, how they can then find you either online or your practice?
Yeah, totally. I practice at OHSU Adventist Health Portland 99% of the time. I also occasionally see patients and do surgery on the main OHSU campus as well. Sorry, and OHSU is the Oregon Health and Science University. I'm part of the Department of Urology there. So they can find me on the website for Oregon Health and Science University. But they can also find me on the website for Adventist Health Portland. Love taking care of patients who are experiencing these issues, because I think there's a lot that I have to offer them. My background and training, I took care of a lot of these patients. And I feel like I'm rambling right now.
Yeah, we got it, dude. You're good. You're a great doctor. Yeah, yeah. You're an excellent surgeon. We support you, Dr. Daniel Furlong. So, as always, to our listeners, I'm going to wrap this up because that was awesome. So as always, thanks to our listeners for listening. You know, download, subscribe, give us a review, 5 stars. Comments are always appreciated, but subscriptions are even more appreciated. You can find us on Spotify, iTunes, Amazon, all podcasting platforms. You can check us out at our website. What's our website, Kev?
It is www.themanuppod.com.
And you can also find us on all of our socials at The Man Up Pod on TikTok, Instagram, Twitter. And then we are also on YouTube, so subscribe there and you can watch these the videos there and see Dr. Furlong's beautiful face on that video. So thanks as always. Thanks to Dr. Furlong. It's always good catching up with him. Until next time, have a good one, guys.